Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is our government starting illegal wars and keeping them going as long as possible just to divert as much of our taxpayers' money as possible to private military companies? Also, the documentary Maidan Massacre has still not been shown on British television. Why not? Because not only does the British establishment not want us to know who shot down the Malaysian airliner MH17, they don't want us to know about the US and EU-backed coup, which brought far-right extremists, amongst others, to power in Ukraine. That happened in Kiev, Maidan Square, in February last year. Also, how much personal data about us all are government agencies across the EU collecting? And more to the point, what are they collecting it for? Plus, microchipping your dog with a tiny transponder. It might seem innocent enough, but will it cause cancer? And can these chips cause cancer in humans too? Also, The Battle for Your Mind, Part 2. Scott Bennett was a psychological warfare officer in the US Army till he was arrested under a minor charge and jailed for simply doing his job for the same private military contractor as whistleblower Edward Snowden, Booz Allen Hamilton. In jail, he met others who realised their job was not to win wars, but to keep them going as long as possible. And I'm joined on the line now by Scott Bennett from the United States, from California, I think. Scott, hi and welcome to The Politics Show. Try and get him back in a little while, but anyhow, I can see Scott on my screen here. He's trying to speak, but we can't hear him. Anyway, in the meantime, let's go to another guest in the studio. That's David Powell from Friends of the Earth Southwest. Actually, no, you're from Friends of the Earth nationally, David, aren't you?
I am, yeah, but I'm fortunate to be based in our beautiful city.
Okay, yeah. Give us your take on the re-election of the Conservatives. Of course, it's not going to be a I suppose we're mainly thinking really about the energy policy here, of what is likely to be with this new government, what changes we're likely to see, if any.
Well, I think mostly we're going to see more of the same. What might become obvious quite quickly, I think, is exactly how much influence the Liberal Democrats did have on Tory environment policy. So the Conservative manifesto was pretty clear about the things it didn't like anymore. Doesn't like onshore wind farms, so there's going to be no more subsidy for onshore wind, and they reckon they're going to get rid of any new ones pretty much entirely. They are big fans of fracking, as we've talked about before. Fracking is hugely unpopular now, even more than it ever was. Before the election, the Tories basically went quiet about it, but you can expect them to go a lot less quiet about it from now on. And all of the things that the Conservatives thought before were good ideas and bad ideas, they will continue to think of good and bad ideas. So that means still pushing for a new nuclear power station at Hinkley, more fracking, like I said, no money to insulate homes, and generally more of the same, Tony, to be honest.
Well, what do you think, there's any positivity that may come out of the changes? I mean, is there any positive policies that may pursue?
I suppose the big question, Mike, it's a good question. The big question is how much of whether or not we sort out our environment, sort out our energy system, is anything to do with government at all, actually.
Yeah.
So if you look at what's happened to the cost of renewable energy over the last 5 years, it's gone berserk. It's gone incredible. So the price of solar panels is at less than half what it was at the last election. Price of wind is coming down. All around the world, countries are going for it. We've seen commitments from China, who've cut their coal use, commitments from the USA. So I was writing something before I left to come down here today. I was just thinking, actually, what if you really wanted to derail the UK's green progress, you'd really struggle to do it, actually, just because the economics have got so much better. So I think actually the biggest reason to be cheerful is I think we're basically on the right path, and it's a question of how much support the government gives it.
But what about the effect of a lower oil price, for example, which is, you know, given a slight, you know, the real wages have just about crept ahead of inflation as a result of that, and perhaps helped the Tories to win the election, and that obviously is going to encourage, you know, the oil economy to some extent.
To some extent, although I suppose your guess is as good as mine as to what happens to the oil price in the long run. I think what it will, there's a huge amount of questions about the North Sea and the oil industry up there. The Chancellor, the government are very, very sensitive to it. They want to protect those jobs. He's trying to do all he can to cut tax, but that's not really doing much about the oil price fundamentally. In the long run, the price of oil is going to going to go up. The question is, the question is when, really. And I think, you know, the bigger question, I usually come on here and talk about specific bits of green policy, but really the big issues that are going to shape whether this is a green government or not are those sort of things you talk about, Martin. They are, what's the oil price? What are we doing about Europe? You know, two-thirds of environmental legislation comes from Europe. If we're just consumed with debating that for the next couple of years, what does that mean? What is the role of big business? What happens to the Tory right? You know, and it's an interesting question, I guess, that, you know, you guys know as much about as I do, whether or not having a very small majority, which is made up in quite significant part from people who are worried about doing too much about climate change, whether that's worse than going into a coalition with a whole bunch of Lib Dems who at least thought it was a good thing to be green.
Now, one of the things that came up on Wednesday at Castle Park when Rosabelle was talking to people there was fracking and nuclear, Dave. So let's just have a little listen to what one of the participants at the anti-austerity protest, ostensibly, but lots of people, lots and lots of things to say, not just about austerity, but also about energy.
Are you against fracking and maybe as well nuclear power?
I am against both of those. I think both of them are investments in completely the wrong direction. Renewables and technology around storage are just ripe for the taking. You know, we need to invest in those now for the sake of our climate and to get our economy going back. There's a lot of placards here saying, you know, no cuts, a million climate jobs, and that's exactly what we need.
Yeah, so that's really interesting for a couple of reasons, I think, Tony. The first is, I mean, this is the, what I was just going to say to Martin before you played that really good clip. Actually, what I think we're going to have now is, and we've seen this at Friends of the Earth where I work, you know where you stand with a Tory government, right? When you've got a coalition, you don't know where you stand so much. With a Tory government, you know they want to frack and they're going to chuck everything they can at fracking. And actually, it makes organisations like Friends of the Earth, like the guys on that march, it makes people be prepared to stand up and push back against it, maybe in a way that it's taken us a bit of, you know, taken it to come to this to happen. I think fracking is hugely unpopular. I mean, you've got it up in Lancashire right now. There's yet another decision that's going on, I think, in the middle of June, where the council will yet again vote on whether or not to allow fracking. And I watched that film, I don't know if you guys have seen it, Gasland, the other day, which is the film that's in America, 6 years old now, but it's the film where they show the very real immediate environmental impacts of what fracking can do, what it can do to the water, what it can do to the local environment. I cannot, the more I think about it, I cannot see fracking taking off. And the government, the coalition government, you know, mostly Tory, bit of Lib Dem, threw so much tax money, so many tax breaks, so many financial bungs, so much of their time and effort, and Osborne was shown to be, you know, colluding behind the scenes in trying to get fracking on everyone's priority list. And still people don't want it. Still it's hugely unpopular. And, you know, we had a march a couple of days ago in Bristol, wasn't really covered in the national press. I was in London at the time, didn't see it, where 4,000 people came on. You've been talking about it in the last hour. Can you imagine what the people of Bristol are going to do if they try and frack around here? It's absolutely extraordinary.
Well, that's, yes, I mean, I think what's interesting in Bristol has bucked the national trend. The Liberals have collapsed around here, effectively, and the Labour Party and the Greens did, you know, pretty well. I think this is going to raise questions about how Bristol fits into its city region. We were talking earlier about the idea of having devolution to city regions. That implies that the suburban areas around Bristol would come under the control of Bristol, which is rational from a planning point of view, but very politically difficult because there's actually a big divide between the two. I think fracking in the southwest is going to find a lot of opposition from Bristol. It's not far. People can either get on their bikes or in their cars to go and protest.
What about the economics of it, though, Martin? I mean, we're in a situation where the oil price has gone down. Is fracking actually
That's right. I think it was a bubble anyway. A lot of what was going on in the US was that the frackers required basically leverage finance from Wall Street in order to function. And the fact is that the fracking bubble bursting in the US could be the trigger that brings down the financial system, because it was very much at the margin of what was viable and required some pretty junk financing in order to proceed. So all of these things are linked, in a way, that's probably, I'm pretty confident that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, and you're right about that in America, and over here as well. I think the what the price of oil that you need in order for fracking to be worth it is higher than the price of oil is right now. So an awful lot of fracking companies, irrespective of the fact that only 24% of the UK public actually want it, a lot of them are going, well, it's not even economically viable anymore. You know, you're asking me about the oil price a while ago. And every time there's a delay in a protest, and every time someone gets up and goes to a protest, travels from Bristol to the Mendips or from London to Lancashire at Help Out, every time they do that, you are actively materially affecting the chances of fracking happening. It's a bit like a marginal. Fracking's one of those. It's the climate issue that's like a marginal. It really could go either way. It really could be something that happens one way or the other.
What about the sort of more geostrategic aspect of this? Because your energy industry, Martin, is incredibly powerful, isn't it? I mean, you look at these massive companies like BP and Shell. I noticed just this week, John Saws, the former director of MI6, is now on the board of BP. He's just been appointed to the board of BP, it's not BP itself. It's a company that advises. It's very close to these kind of energy policies. I think it's called Macro or something. But anyway, there seems to be quite a sort of distant from the public area where energy is actually at the centre of world events.
Well, it is, because if you look at the war in the Ukraine and the war in Syria, it's effectively about oil pipelines in both cases. And the real struggle is to direct oil pipelines through your territory and keep them away from your enemies. So there's been some suggestion that the armed rebellion by the Kosovo Liberation Army inside Macedonia in the last week, where they killed several police officers and had a run-in with the authorities. This is part of NATO's strategy to undermine the South Stream pipeline, which is going to be coming from Russia to Turkey, from Turkey to Greece and through the Balkans. And that is actually a way of cutting out Ukraine and allowing the European Union to get oil, gas directly from the Russians without having to go through Ukraine. And, you know, I'm afraid that in Syria, a similar situation where the Saudis and the Qataris want to run a pipeline through Syria to Tarsus. And, of course, the current Syrian government wants to run an Iranian pipeline to the same destination. And I'm afraid you find that an awful lot of the fighting that's going on in the world, I would say, is directly linked to these oil and gas geopolitics. And a lot of what we're told it's about is actually delusionary and disinformation.
Don't forget, you know, that energy is... This is the reason that it has such a high profile. This is the reason that the Chancellor gets so involved, that the Prime Minister gets so involved with wanting fracking to happen. It's seen as being a national security thing. And, you know, I suppose partially with good reason. You could imagine what would happen to stable civilization in this country if the lights did go off for, you know, a couple of days at a time. And politicians are terrified of that, actually, which is why when Friends of the Earth is calling for what we want everyone to own their own energy, solar panels on every roof, you know, communities to have a stake in the local wind turbine that's on their hill. That's what you want. And one of the reasons why renewable energy could get even more popular is if people have a stake in it and it works for them and it actually allows them to control their own energy. That's the sort of system that we want, I think. People look at something like fracking and they see it as being done to them. They see it as a big company coming in, putting something unpleasant on their area. They don't get any benefits from it. It doesn't directly help them keep the lights on in their area, and they take it away again. So we probably need to think, if we're serious about energy security and trying to have something positive to say about the environment in that, let's think about what decentralised renewables, solar panels everywhere could do for national security quite a lot.
I mean, it's happening a lot on the continent, particularly in Germany. What are the Germans doing that we're not?
Well, that's a great question. And a lot of it comes from who are the Germans that we're not, right? So the Germans, about 60 or 70 years ago, had a bit of a skirmish. And they emerged from the Second World War sort of shell-shocked as a nation. And there was a massive cultural reaction in Germany. You know, that's where the German Greens became so big. Turned their back on nuclear, sort of fairly obvious kind of parallels with the war, and they became at that point a country that wanted to reinvent itself. And emerging from that cultural moment was a very strong environmental consciousness. Over there, they didn't decide to go for renewables just kind of happened. They've also got a lot more, you were talking to the lady before the hour there, they've got a lot more local control just as a country, you know, far more decentralised, far greater ability for local areas to do renewable energy systems that actually work for their local areas. It's a national consciousness thing, and we need to get that over here as well.
I remember over in the United States, Martin, when the privatisation of energy happened over there, which was a long time before it did here. I mean, we had during the Thatcher eras. I mean, basically what happens is the companies cut costs and cut costs so much that the energy energy infrastructure actually, never mind where the actual energy is coming from, it all becomes really fragile because most of the profits are going to shareholders. They're not going into the network anymore.
Well, in, even in places like the US, which has largely had privatised utilities, you've got to regulate those utilities. There's no other way of doing it. But, of course, the real solution in the end is, A, decentralisation and renewables. And the other thing is energy saving. Absolutely. Which is the biggest way to do this. We could just re-engineer our whole technology so that we need a fraction of the energy that we're now using. We know how to do it. We just haven't got the will to do it.
Why is there not the political will then, David?
Oh, I'll tell you why that is, Tony. And I wish it wasn't as mundane as this, right? But I honestly think it's very hard to open in a grand political statement. It's very hard to open some loft insulation. You know, politicians like building big things. They like big infrastructure projects. They like big new railways. They like big nuclear power stations. They like a thing that when they retire, they can, you know, look back at the thing that they did. It's phenomenally unsexy insulating every home in this country to the same standard as they are in Sweden. In Sweden, where it is, you know, a lot colder than it is here, the homes are a lot warmer. They use a lot less energy because they're built properly in the first place and there's proper programs of insulation. In the way businesses use energy, all of this stuff, it's, the economic case for it is absolutely, you know, closed. No question at all. You invest a bit of money up front, it pays you back no matter what you're doing. At some point you will pay back and you'll be in the black as a result of it. But we don't have the culture of doing it. We don't have the incentives for doing it either. You could do things. Imagine if council tax was varied so that you're obviously given a bit of time to sort it out, but that you pay less council tax if you've got a warmer home, or stamp duty has changed so that when you sell your house, you're incentivizing people to actually insulate their homes properly. We could do all of that stuff. But one of the things, you asked me about Germany earlier, Tony, one of the things that I think is a very British phenomenon is your home being your castle. And there's a real cultural resistance in this country to people thinking that the government is telling them what to do in their own house, even if it saves them money, even if it keeps their kids warm, even if, you know, it improves your physical health, all of this stuff. There's a resistance to it. The Labour government, which didn't get in, had some semi-decent policies on it. The Tories, one of the real disappointments is even that they understand the economic argument, but they're not prepared to actually, you know, be seen to be intervening and telling people what to do in their house. So we're wasting huge amounts of money. The jobs we could be creating everywhere, here in Bristol, all around the country, going out insulating people's homes, we're not making. We're costing the NHS £1 billion a year, which is what living in a cold house does to people. There's all sorts of studies show that kids don't do their homework as well in cold houses, actually linked to people's educational performance. Huge amounts of stuff we could do. Martin's absolutely spot on. It's a major Cinderella policy.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing about it, is that we always think of trying to find solutions which are on the supply side, and it's the demand side which really needs to be resolved. And that doesn't mean that you have to cut your standard of living at the average at all. There's no reason for that.
Just like to test to see if Scott Bennett's able to join us now. Scott, hi, are you there?
Yes, Tony, I'm here with you.
Hooray, hooray. I feel like cheering now. But anyway, before we finish with talking to Scott Bennett, I just wonder, what if you've got any contribution to make, Scott, about the discussion we're having there about energy and international energy and how the energy companies and to what extent they have influence on our national policy. Martin was suggesting, perish the thought, that actually some of the energy policy is based around, or some of the wars are not based around moral issues. They're actually based around energy grabs.
Well, I would absolutely concur with that analysis. The wars are entirely generated by a monetary agenda that is focused as oil as the commodity, as well as the gold stock that is hidden in a lot of these countries. The oil companies that are working in tandem with the defense contractors, with the politicians as the puppets that simply smile and nod and sign their name on the congressional legislation, it's very much a corporate operation.
So, I mean, for example, with somewhere like Libya, I mean, that isn't actually known as a massive oil producer. So what's going on in some of these conflicts, Scott?
Well, Libya, for example, you've got a destabilized country that was sort of a pain before, and now it's become a bleeding ulcer now. And it's chalked up as serious ignorance by the U.S. policy and military makers, or a serious corruption of agendas and unconstitutional activities. I always would like to fall on the ignorant side, but it's not. They've gone into Libya, they've destabilized it, they've thrown out the government, so you're going to have civil wars there between warring tribes and factions that that are very similar to what the United States experienced between the Sioux and the Apache and all these Indian tribes when they were fighting each other. The same applies over there in the desert. Only with Libya, you've got a significant historical site. You do have certain reserves of gold that the Israelis have set up an operation to secretly confiscate. And you now have a mass exodus of people leaving the north of Africa through Libya to get into Europe because of the humanitarian suffering. That's what every Briton should be concerned about and outraged by, is that the United States is going into these Middle Eastern countries, causing chaos and sending the human destruction over to Europe, and specifically Britain. Britain, and I know Britain. I was born in Scotland. I have family in Britain, and I know Britain is the jewel of the European continent with regards to freedom and capitalism, entrepreneurship, and that's why all these migrants are struggling and dying to reach its shores.
Now, look, so, Scott, you've been at quite a high level in the US, for example, having meetings with Donald Rumsfeld, people like that. Give us a bit of an insight into how these energy firms operate at the highest level, because I know they have quite a lot of access, don't they, to top politicians, top banks, that kind of thing.
Well, you have their own private security companies and intelligence sectors within the energy companies. You've got a lot of money that is given for American elections. That, of course, is the driving force behind all of American political choices, because you have a group that doesn't want to cede power. It thrives on making, you know, decisions in Washington, and these oil companies are all the too happy to comply. You've got a lot of think tanks that are funded by big companies for their research projects. So it's really follow the money. I would say what we're now experiencing with the Ukraine sector, for example, you see the energy cabal beginning to assemble there, and that's why it was interesting to see the vice president's son being appointed as one of the energy liaisons to that firm. So the U.S., its energy theory is to drain all nations of the world until the U.S. is the last man standing with energy. And they're doing that. They're pursuing that policy in the Middle East, and it's enabled by Israel, because Israel is benefiting from the destabilized countries because they're easy to loot, they're easy to plunder. Europe is suffering because all of the human wreckage is going over to Europe, over the Mediterranean, to Italy, eventually to Germany. And the same will happen with Syria. When the U.S. eventually destabilizes Syria to go the way of Libya, you'll have all of the Syrian exodus into Europe. So it doesn't lead anything good. This U.S. policy of destabilization has damaged European and European interests, and British people should be outraged. But the energy companies drive the political process in a lot of these decisions in America, and it's enabled by the media. The media has an agenda for keeping people on the edge of their seats, keeping them fearful, so they'll tune in to their constant feeding of, you know, hysterical propaganda about ISIS around every corner, Muslims preparing to jump out of planes to land in Texas and take over the United States one county at a time. But that's the narrative that is postulated by once reputable media institutions such as the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. I saw it up close and personal. And my experiences with the media. I wrote, when I discovered my whistleblowing issues involving Swiss banks and terrorist financing and Saudi donors and the Gulf states, I reported that up to all of the media institutions, asking, begging, pleading for them to investigate this, investigate me, to discover all of the material is accurate, and not one media source did one single thing. They ignored it, they ran away from it, and they attacked me for it.
Why do you think that is, Scott? I mean, you know, you're a reputable guy, actually. Apart from your housing violation that you were sent to jail for, which really does seem rather minor, I mean, you're an inside source for these media.
Well, that was the most fascinating thing about this tale, is that that's the only reason they sent me to prison, was because I was doing my job in the military and the defense contractor realm. I was finding money sources. I was finding shady behavior. I was seeing bribes. I was seeing corruption. I was seeing royal families sending all the terrorists to other countries besides their own. And I saw a lot of secret, shady U.S. intelligence money sources going to some of these operations. And when I started asking questions and making noise and filing reports up the military chain of command, the next thing I know, I'm stopped at a front gate and I'm accused of filling out a housing contract wrong. And that was used to jettison me from my position. And then they prosecuted me a short time later. And I thought it was a complete joke. But next thing I know, they throw me right in prison to silence me. But I just kept reporting what I kept discovering as a military officer. I kept reporting that I was seeing connections and documents and persons that warranted U.S. discovery, and no answers whatsoever. Now, that is still in the legal process. That will still be eventually brought out and seen in the courts. But it just shows there is no genuine interest in protecting the citizens of the United States and their safety and their security using intelligence that is actionable. That's a complete lie. It's a complete hypocrisy. Because if they were, they would have jumped on this material that Brad Birkenfeld and I supplied. And they never did. They hid it. They covered it up. They attacked me. They tried to discredit me as somebody impostering a military person, but it's all, it was a very half-hearted, half-wit attempt. It certainly wasn't successful, but it's still in the process of discovery. But
Scott, can I just stop you there? Sorry, but I mean, we've got David Powell from Friends of the Earth in with us here. We've been discussing energy. I mean, what we want to see is a more system in Britain, and I imagine you do in the US, rather more like Germany, where energy is much more spread out with renewable energy, things like solar, wind power, this kind of thing, that is not controlled by a few tiny companies. From your insight, is there any real prospect of that in Britain and the US?
Well, I would say one of the dangers that the U.S. faces is the monopolization of the oil and energy industry. And they do have federal laws that are geared to preventing that, but they've been relatively surrendered and inactive. I'd say, yeah, there's a very big danger when oil companies are paying academic professors at universities to do research and reinforce studies that sort of toe the bottom line and set the agenda for fracking and things that have already been sort of proven to be environmentally damaging, but the intelligence is skewed. They're corrupting it with an agenda motive that's more monetary and corporate in their interests. How do you rectify it? You have to go through the political process and the information process. That's why the media is essential, but if they're not standing up as an institution, then it needs to be stood up by individuals such as yourself, who are going out and creating websites and radio shows and TV shows and advertising the truth and trusting that people will gravitate to speakers with authority and speakers who are intelligent and reasonable, don't talk in sound bites, and aren't afraid to be aggressive and expose in interviews these decision makers.
Now, David, I wonder what your thoughts are about. I mean, it's quite a privilege to get access to Scott, who's been in the system in the US. He's seen how things can really work sometimes. Do you ever feel a little bit powerless? Because, I mean, we as campaigners, I'm a campaigning journalist, you're working for Friends of the Earth, environmental campaign, seem so far down the food chain that there's big decisions being made by energy companies and a fantastic amount of money being spent on lobbying by the energy industry to create the laws that allow things like fracking. I mean, it's an amazing thing in a way that fracking isn't happening just simply because the oil price has been depressed. In a way, that's really lucky, providential, know. But I mean, I wonder what your thoughts are about how we roll back that power that's coming from above, where politicians essentially aren't even really in the driving seat anymore. We've just had our general election, but we're wondering, we're scratching our heads, well, will these guys really change anything?
Great question, and hello, Scott.
Well, yeah, a bit of a long question.
I'll give you a long answer if you like. I think actually the only thing that's going to, for a campaigning organisation, for campaigning journalists, it's about getting people interested, getting people motivated and exercised, and people understanding what's going on. You know, the civil rights changes that we've seen around the world didn't happen because a couple of politicians fought for it. I mean, there were good politicians out there doing it, but they fought because people demanded it. But all of the major changes that we've seen have happened either through some sort of major shock, or failing that, some sort of massive uprising of people. And that's what we're going to get. And what I think is really interesting, and the author Naomi Klein has done a huge amount of stuff on this recently, is actually when you look at something like climate change and the energy system, just like we've been talking about, I think people are beginning to realise this isn't just about some obscure bit of environmental policy or something that's on the side. Fundamental to the way that we run our economies and our society are these massive problems. Climate is trade, is economics, is geopolitics, and all of these things come together. And I actually think the things that will sort out ultimately climate change and energy monopolies and all of these things are going to be something that looks a bit different. They're going to be people demanding control of their energy system, rejecting fracking being put on them, and things like that. And I think you're absolutely right, Tony, when you say it is remarkable that here in the UK we haven't had fracking, considering not just, you know, that the economic pressure that's coming from the big companies, but also how much this government wants to do it. But there is only one reason we haven't, and that's because people all around the country have said no way, we don't want it. Sorry, Scott, but we've looked at America and we've seen what fracking has done to your beautiful country, and we've said we don't want that over here. And that gives me huge encouragement, actually. And I think if we're going to have a Conservative government for the next 5 years, if it lasts that long, I think we're only going to see more of that sort of thing like we did in 1992.
I guess I mean, there's the price of energy being one thing that's stopped fracking, but it's also the lack of investors. People are a bit hesitant about investing in something when they can see a whole army of protesters turning up on the site to stop it.
Absolutely. And you know, this is it. Like I was saying 10 minutes ago, fracking is incredibly delicate in this country. Over in America, there are these big decisions like Keystone, which I'm sure you can, the huge pipeline, which I'm sure Scott can talk about, this massive decision that needed to be taken and still hasn't been properly taken, as I understand it, about whether you build this colossal great bit of infrastructure to take dirty oil from Canada, take it down through the States. Over here, it's fracking. But there are these everyday, day-to-day decisions where protesters are out protesting. People are out there rejecting the idea of stuff being imposed on them, which is having massive financial consequences, because investors are getting nervous, the stock prices are falling, cost of capital is going up, and people are going, you know what, it's not worth it. And for a lot of investors, particularly investors who will just go and put their money into something else, thank you very much, they're getting scared, and they should be.
Okay, David, well, thanks very much for joining us. We're going to carry on, talk to Scott a bit more about his discovery of Swiss banks financing terrorism in the Middle East through the CIA, through Saudi individuals, and how he was thrown out of a job for telling his boss, actually just for doing his job effectively. But thanks very much for joining us. Maybe you'd just like to finish and tell us where we can find stuff from Friends of the Earth and what you're up to over the next few months.
As always, yeah, thanks, Tony. The big thing we've got going on nationally is up in fracking in Lancashire. Lancashire is the pivotal point. It's our key stone. It's the place where fight is going on. Find out more on our website at www.foe.co.uk, or call us up 0207 490 1555.
Okay, David Powell, economics researcher for Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers, Dave.
And with you still, Scott, let's go on to talk about some of the experience that you've had. I mean, you were saying that you were targeting, you're doing psychological warfare as part of the U.S. Army. Can you tell us how psychological warfare works?
Well, yeah, it's sort of an interesting segue, because one of the things I was going to share with you and David just before you left on the environmental level, that's been a huge psyop. That's been a huge psychological operations. And I think it's been done poorly, as all psychological operations in the United States have been very pathetic, I think, in their design. But the environmental psyop has been negative. It's been fear-based. It's been dreading the inevitable melting of the glaciers, death of the polar bear, the green plants will all wither and die, blah, blah, blah. And that's a very fear-based motivation, and that only reaches a certain action trigger. instead, the truth, if Britain really wants to reestablish itself and perhaps even reclaim some of its empire and information, it needs to be the positive source of environmental intelligence. It needs to be the productive, creative steward of the environment. And you can get exaggerated, but that's what PSYOP is all about, exaggerating the imagination so people are overloaded with feelings and emotions, and those trigger cognitive choices and physical actions. And that PSYOP material for the environmental thing, for example, you see that in, for example, homes that resemble the Hobbits, green trees and green environment, and children playing in flower fields, and Star Trek sort of organized technology. Things that give people a hopeful anticipation of the future if they follow the choice of intelligent environmental operations and stewardship, rather than you better stop driving, you better stop cooking, and you better stop doing all this stuff, or else you're going to suffer and you're going to be, you know, in a world full of ashes and gray smoke.
I think people, what you're saying, effectively, Scott, there is accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative. I'd just like to bring old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in there, because, I mean, we're talking about some big stuff here. It's like, who really runs the world and why? And a lot of it has to do with energy, doesn't it?
It does, well, but it's also...
Well, hang on, Scott, you were going to say something there.
No, please, go ahead.
Come on, Martin.
Well, it's also got to do with financial manipulations. The petrodollar is the key keystone of the international system. In other words, the agreement between the US and the Saudis that essentially oil will be traded in dollars, which means that, you know, poor countries, for example, in order to buy their imports, have to have dollars in order to do so. And of course, the Libyans were trying to develop the Libyan gold dinar as a potential alternative. The Iraqis were talking about trading their oil in euros before they were invaded. And now we've got things like the Asian Investment Bank that's been set up in defiance of US policy. The tectonic plates are moving, but it's the relationship between energy and finance which I think is the key, not just energy on its own.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Scott, yeah, give us a bit of an insight though into particularly how the you saw, I mean, because you were working in this area, what kind of operations you were doing against the Muslim population? Because I know you were actually recruited because of your background in advertising. Maybe you can explain a bit about that and how that was adapted by the military.
Yeah, well, I had entered the fold back in 2000 when I went to Britain and worked with some interesting characters from Oxford Intelligence, MI6, and some USAID CIA agencies on foreign direct investment, economic development in Eastern Europe as well as the Pacific. And my background academically and from a theory point of view was cultivating Islamic mindsets to be receptive for economic development, business, capital, prosperity, generating small micro business loans to get people doing something other than war, whether it's falafel stands or camel breeding or digging oil out of the sands or doing high tech, doing computerization or offshore calling, things of any description that an indigenous population might have a proclivity to. I was developing communications and materials that would be used to cultivate that. It was sort of like going into a brown field and trying to turn it green. It had been brown from, well, U.S. intervention, U.S. coup d'etats for the past 50 years, and all sorts of other colorful geopolitical activities. And I was trying to go in and purify a lot of that soil, purify the mentality and the identity. Anyway, that's a long way of saying that's how I started in 2000. 2001 hit with the very colorful, if not false flag, of the 9/11 attacks, and I was in my doctorate, and I then put off joining the military and continued to serve in the Bush administration, and I got wrapped up in foreign direct investment and Bush domestic policies, but I got roped into the Pentagon defense contractor establishment because they were looking for people to do psychological warfare. And my work was very almost the kissing cousin of psychological warfare. It was advertising. It was strategic communications. It was psychological persuasion. It was religious intuition and taking the religious impulses of the Muslim mind and channeling it in a positive capitalistic way.
But of course, the thing is, Scott, is that that's happened in the opposite direction completely with ISIS. So what's been going on there?
Well, that's was the biggest frustration I had from the very beginning. Is I was trying to go down the right road and I kept being sidetracked. I kept being stopped. I kept being forbidden. And then eventually I was attacked and imprisoned for it. And I mean, I was at the highest levels of the information counterterrorism world. I was at the State Department and Special Operations Command and U.S. Central Command. I had a top secret SCI clearance and I worked with who I thought were the best and brightest people. And I found it very sorely deficient. The smartest guys that I met were British that came over and were contractors for the State Department in cultivating strategic communications in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I found them very refreshing because they could think outside the box and they had the encyclopedia of history as their foundation for building communication campaigns. They had the British Empire and the East India Company and the indigenous research on how to deal with these cultures. And the U.S. was very shallow and very very one-color inclined. And
can you give us an idea of maybe what one or two of the kind of campaigns you were running, just to give us an idea of what this actually means on the ground, the work you were doing and how it was expressed and how the public would come across it?
Well, yeah, none of it's classified. I only discuss unclassified stuff, but some of it was developing comic books that attack the Islamic radical, the Islamic terrorist mind who was looking to, well, currently ISIS. This was back in 2008, 2009. We produced material when I was at Booz Allen Hamilton with Colonel Jeff Jones, who was a very brilliant thinker. He was a colonel in psychological operations, and him and I put together a comic book idea that was going to be geared towards a certain indigenous population so that over 10 years you would generate a following, and you would have a 10 years from a young kid who was 10 years old to 20, you could really gain ownership over a lot of his loyalties and his identity. As intelligent and well-founded as an advertising campaign as that was, the entire military intelligence and political establishment rejected it. And now, you know, like 7-8 years later, they're now starting to explore what we proposed back in 2007, 8, and 9.
Well, you know what this makes me think is that some of the campaigns, the psychological warfare, or the just generally the milieu in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabism, all that kind of thing, imagine that there were similar campaigns that have been running for a decade or longer that have actually tried to persuade people to have the mindset to join ISIS even.
Well, that's the craziest thing is that you have that, and you have the ISIS camp that came out of the Wahhabist Gulf nations, and yet the U.S. is allied at the hip with those Gulf nations. You just saw the news report I sent you this morning, where it's reported Obama is standing up and basically declaring to stand with all these Gulf nations in any sort of military conflict or exercise. He's basically proclaiming war, but doing it quietly. And Americans don't see that. The media spins it in a completely different direction, as if we're assuming a defensive posture. We are not assuming a defensive posture. We are continuing. We are doubling down on our offensive posture. And the problem is the U.S. policy, the U.S. military, and the U.S. energy establishment looks at the entire Middle East like a shanty town, like a bunch of bums living under a freeway, under tents, as you've seen with these African migrants who are going into France. That's how the U.S. views a lot of these people in the Middle East and their regimes and their governments. And what do? They go in and they wipe out the tents and plant little new ones and try and jockey for power and influence. And then you have the religious Wahhabists who stand up and say, thank you very much for the guns and the weapons and the ammunition. And they do it very persuasively. That's one of the most brilliant things they've done, is they have effectively tapped into the U.S. policymaker, like John McCain. He's a good example. They've tapped into John McCain's latent personality dysfunctions, which is peculiar in particular to the American culture and the American identity. In a country, America has its own characteristics of sort of marital instability, high rate of divorce, family dissolution. It does not share a lot of the conservative family impulses that really are prevalent in Eastern Europe or Russia or the Middle East. And I saw that up close and personal. And the John McCain's and Lindsey Graham's, who, I mean, Lindsey Graham is all sorts of dysfunctionalities. The ISIS fighters have come alongside and seduced the McCain and Lindsey Graham personalities. They've spoken like warm butter. They've been charming. They've been little, you know, smiley, happy, petting people, and ingratiate themselves like little servant boys in Lawrence of Arabia, if you will. And that just pets the ego the right way, and John McCain and Lindsey Graham and these others walk away feeling more humanly fulfilled. They feel this warm, fuzzy emotion, and that guides their policy choices. So it's not about logic. It's not about intelligence. It's not about analyzing the culture and the personality profiles and the political history and the economic viability of a country and a region. It's all about emotion and love and the promises of these ISIS Wahhabi types who have as their war agenda deceive them with every stratagem of war.
Scott, where's this going to end? We've got about another minute to go, but can you just tell us, where are we heading?
Well, you know, unfortunately, it's not going to be turned, I think, by the current American political establishment, and Britain may. I mean, it may call Cameron to be pulled out, but you're going to have an increased role in Russia and Syria, and I think China, in pushing back on the Western operations, and Europe is going to incline to go with Russia, China, and Syria. I think they're going to abandon the U.S. Allegiance. They're going to do it quietly and softly and gradually, but they're going to pull away because it's not in their best interest to continue this war operation, especially in the next 6 months when we see a mass exodus of people from Africa and the Middle East starting to swarm into the Mediterranean and Europe. I think that's only going to increase as long as the instability lasts and there's no infrastructure. And we saw that in Iraq. The whole middle class left Iraq. The same thing is going to happen, you know, in Syria. The Wahhabist nations, you could have Iran and Saudi Arabia be the trigger point for a U.S. military engagement, which could be very, very, very damaging. So.
And also, I suppose another final question, if you want, though, is someone that's worked in psychological warfare, psychological operations, Scott, for people just kind of trying to make sense of the world, watching what's going on TV, watching the news, that kind of thing. What guidance have you got for them for actually reading behind the headlines, between the lines?
You have to be educated and intelligent and know the research and the history of the target audiences. You have to know the difference between the tribes and the cultures and their religious beliefs and their whole history. And sadly, a lot of the American and Western NATO people do not really fully understand that. And they're blown by profit motives. They're blown by money from U.S. Promises and CIA operations and Swiss banks, all of that stuff that I reported. They're driving a lot of this agenda. I'm hopeful that the American people will wake up and choose a much more restrained policy, will change gears, will get back onto a peace advancing agenda rather than war, because it's decimated our economy and it's decimated our reputation. I don't know any Middle Eastern country whose people have a positive feeling for Britain or the United States or any European at this point. And look at Russia. There's a prime example. Russia is like 80-90% of its people are very negative towards the U.S. and NATO for very good reasons. I mean, we've given them reason to. The Wahhabist Gulf nations, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, they're all gearing towards Iran, and Israel is gearing towards Iran, and the U.S. is gearing towards Iran. I don't think Russia and China will let that happen, because they'll know they're the next one to fall if Russia, if Iran turns into a Syria or Iraq.
Okay, Scott Bennett, former psychological warfare officer. We had a little bit of an interview with you from another show last week, and very happy to have you with us this week. Scott Bennett, thanks very much for joining us here on The Politics Show.
Thank you, Tony.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
So that was Scott Bennett there. Martin Summers, let's go on now to talk a bit about what Scott was talking about in a way, and that is the problem that we have with our mainstream press not telling us stuff. And there's this documentary you pointed out to me before the general election, which is called Maidan Massacre. We've not seen it here in Britain at all, and yet it goes into real detail, doesn't it, as to what actually happened in February last year at the Maidan Square, and does the obvious thing, what you think would be the obvious thing, what we used to get on the TV here in Britain, and that is goes and talks to the police officers who were shot at, the ones who were survived, some who were shot, went through hospital, had bullets removed, etc.
And I think psychological warfare isn't just bending people's minds. It also involves acts of violence, which are then spun. And what the film documents is that the shooting of both police officers and liberal protesters was not carried out by the previous Yanukovych regime, but carried out by elements connected to the current regime, specifically Pravi sector militants who've probably been trained in Poland with the latest information that we have. And they shot both police officers and protesters as a basis for running an armed military coup against the democratically elected government, however corrupt it might have been.
Okay, so let's hear an extract from that documentary now.
November 2013. Ukraine President Yanukovych is presented a trade deal with the European Union, a deal which would presumably lead to economic prosperity and take Ukraine under the umbrella of Europe.
A miracle didn't happen, and European Union leaders and Ukraine have, as expected, failed to sign an historic free trade deal after a last-minute U-turn from Kiev.
Ukraine has not signed the association agreement with the EU after all. Ukraine refuses to sign the association agreement with the EU.
But Yanukovych rejected their offer and eventually settled for a more economically favorable deal with Russia.
There have been reports of medics being deliberately targeted.
The clashes lasted for hours and led to deaths on both sides.
The protesters are running their wounded back on stretchers.
They were gunned down mercilessly.
Who were these gunmen who fired on both police and protesters in the Maidan? What does the evidence suggest?
From where I was, I could hear quite clear Mr. Lysenko yelling on stage. That was Khreshchatyk. In the morning, you will have something to fight the police with.
Утром у вас буде то, чим ви зможете боротися з міліцією.
We can tell now that they were shot from the Ukraine hotel 100%. Even those videos on the internet, for example, that bright flash, a shot, and a protester is hit, another flash. It's a shot made from the Ukraine hotel, for sure.
So that was the extract from the documentary, actually made by a US filmmaker, Hollywood filmmaker, and yet still not shown here in Britain, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think the key thing that people have to realise is that what probably happened there, well, the evidence suggests, is that a group of snipers from the Hotel Ukraine shot both police and protesters as the basis of a military coup, and that NATO has a track record of carrying out such atrocities. Similar things happened in Syria and in Venezuela.
Okay. Also, this topic was discussed by our great friend Daniele Ganser when he was speaking to Julian Charles on The Mind Renewed.
You have group of demonstrators on a public square, and then you just fire on them and kill them and say, you know, the government did it, and then you can topple the government. I mean, that was done in Ukraine on February 21, 2014. That's something we all witnessed. That's not even 12 months ago. Mm-hmm. And now the question is obviously, who did the firing? Who were the snipers? And today we know, those people who research secret warfare, that these snipers on the Maidan in Kiev, they killed both demonstrators and policemen. So that's strange, you know. Obviously, if, if you come from this group of research that I do, you wonder, I mean, why did the acting president shoot his own policeman? And I don't believe it, really. I mean, usually they don't do that. And what you then see is that on that day, the government of Yanukovych fell, and the new government of Poroshenko came into place. And the big change here is that Yanukovych was the guy of Moscow, okay? He was a Russian-friendly dictator or oligarch. And now Poroshenko is the guy of Washington. He's a Washington-friendly dictator or oligarch. And, you know, these things are not things of the past. They are things that concern us today, because secret warfare is not something that stopped. I very much think that secret warfare is something that we need to take into account if we look at international politics.
The author of NATO's Secret Army about Operation Gladio, that's Danielle Aganser there, finishing our show today. Sorry we didn't have time for Catherine Albrecht. Microchipping we'll do next week, and the cancer dangers of it. Also, Leveller's Day tomorrow. Do make it up to Burford if you can. I'm Tony Gosling. Our show site is www.thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time next week, and don't let those banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7. Commuters face a miserable end to the Maybank holiday later this month, with the threat of the first national rail strike for around 20 years. Members of the RMT union are walking out for 24 hours in a row over pay.